I'm sure Thomas said you should ask questions during the presentation because he knows that I never stop until the last minute. So if there's a time for questions at the end, there won't be any time for questions at the end unless you interrupt me. So I really should have titled this a little piece of the optimization at Watson, because I mean there are lots of people at Watson working on mixed integer linear programming, mixed integer nonlinear programming, and even nonlinear programming that are certainly not covered in this talk. So first of all, I'm actually going to be talking about two very different classes of problems, and I'm going to begin by talking about derivative-free optimization. And you know, one's comfortable looking at derivative-free problems if you've got approximately, you know, 50 or less variables. And when we've got derivatives, we're going to be talking about problems with tens of thousands or more variables. But first of all, since I'm talking about derivative-free, I want to motivate that. And it really covers an important class of problems, even though they're small. So we're not actually going to be approximating derivatives in the sense of gradient differencing or quasi-Newton methods or automatic differentiation or anything like that. Really, you should think of the objective function as being a black box simulation package. So in fact, automatic differentiation is not even available. And typically one has noisy function values, so finite differencing, besides being expensive, is not particularly a good idea. And the context which I'm most interested in is where the function evaluations themselves are expensive. So maybe it would take, in some cases, 5 or 6 hours to get a single functional evaluation. But in general, the function evaluations are not particularly cheap, so it would be too expensive to do finite differencing. And in fact, there are many complex problems where derivatives are unobtainable. So let me give a few quick examples. I'm going to run through these. There are problems in traffic equilibrium, in energy conversion systems, and you can see Thomas's name up there, in computational fluid dynamics, shape design. The aircraft industry uses them quite a lot. And I want to concentrate on something which is a bit closer to the interest of IBM. So in spite of what Thomas said at the beginning, I'm actually mixing some of the applications with the mathematics. So one application that I want to look at is the tuning of clock distribution networks. So as you know, operations in a chip are done in cycles, maybe 8 cycles per operation. Every part of the chip has to be synchronized at the beginning of each cycle. And the clock distribution network serves to synchronize the chip by sending a signal to every part. So the signal has to arrive everywhere at the same time. There's always distortion and delay. Distortion can be reduced by having buffers, which are essentially inverters, but they cause more delay. And the delay may vary for different parts of the signal. So there's a package which is used at IBM called DEFT, which stands for Derivative Free Tuner. And it's a package which is essentially aimed to assist circuit designers in optimizations of their circuits. It's aimed at small circuits that require the accuracy of a power splice simulator. So in other words, you've got some simulator that's effectively going to do almost as well as you can do in terms of solving the problem, but it's not going to be able to give you derivatives. So the underlying optimization is via open source code that was written by Katia Scheinberg called DFO for derivative-free optimization. I mean, the code is somewhat modified, but that's the basis of the package. And it's actually the first derivative-free circuit tuning package that's based on a formal converging optimization algorithm rather than, you know, sort of using simulation and intelligent guesses, which is, you know, a place to start, but hopefully one can do better by using formal optimization. And in fact, for the clock distribution networks, it made possible trying different objective functions and constraints, and that led to a better understanding of the problem. But in fact, it also found alternative designs which apparently gave much better solutions, and which the circuit designers themselves said they would have unlikely to have come across using manual tuning. So here's the context of the problem. I've got a nonlinear objective function, f of x. I've got some equality constraints, some inequality constraints, and because of the special structure, I nearly always separate out the inequality constraints that are just simple bounds. So they're a separate set of constraints. And I'm going to begin to look at the unconstrained problem. So how are we going to do it? Well, we're going to use the truss region method. And I know that most of you may know what a truss region method is, but for those that don't, I'm going to describe it shortly. I'm going to use interpolation models. I'm going to look at extensions to other models. In fact, I probably won't have time to do that today, but we have worked on extensions to other models. We've also worked on extensions to constraints, and I won't describe that today either. So what is it I require? I know I'm going to minimize the function without knowledge of its first derivatives. So I don't have those. They exist, but I don't have them. I want to use rigorous algorithms, so I want to use algorithms for which I can guarantee global convergence, meaning convergence from any starting point to a stationary point. As I said, I'm going to assume that f is expensive to evaluate, and it's possibly noisy, and in the constrained case, I may not even know what the constraint region is. And that one of the consequences of that is, since the function f is expensive, I can afford to use all the linear algebra I want to, because relative to the cost of evaluating a function, the linear algebra is not going to be the most expensive part. Now, in fact, if I had a context where, and I could have, a context where evaluating the function is inexpensive, then I would have to modify the algorithm that I typically use in DFO. So what is the trust region method? So here's a simple problem in two variables. You can see that it has two local optima, one over there and one over there. And of course, all of these algorithms guarantee to converge to local optima, not global optima. So I don't really know a priori which one I'm going to converge to. And basically, the idea of a trust region method is you're going to take some neighborhood, in this case a spherical neighborhood, of the current point that you're at. You're going to take some model, and in that picture a quadratic model. Within that neighborhood, you're going to minimize the model. Go to that point and see, how well that point compares to... Let's go back to that one again, sorry. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to minimize the model, and then at that point I'm going to compare truth, that is how the true function changed compared to the model function. And if there's good agreement, I'll take the point. If there's very good agreement, I'll take the point and increase the trust region radius. So in that picture, that's exactly what's happened, because you can see I went to the point, this is now the central point of the new region. The region's twice as big. I'm going to minimize this, or approximately minimize it, go to the next point, and so forth. And now you can see I've been successful again, so in fact the trust region's getting very large. And in the next picture, I was not successful, so I had to reduce the trust region radius. And then in the next picture, I've kept the same trust region radius, but now I'm getting close to one of the minima. So each stage I'm minimizing the model and modifying the trust region radius. This time I'm very successful, so I've doubled the trust region radius. And at the next stage, what have I done? I've gone the wrong way. The next stage, the radius has got even larger, and in fact you can't see the trust region anymore. Now if I'd started off at a different point, if I started off at the point up there, I would have converged to the other local minimum. But in either case, in this particular simple problem, it takes 6 iterations to essentially solve the problem. So let's describe that basic algorithm that I tried to show in the pictures there. So I've got an initial point x0, I've got a trust region radius delta, I'm going to compute some model, I'm now going to minimize that model within the trust region, and I'm now going to compare truth, so the change in the true function, with the predicted change in the model function. And if that ratio is large, and I sort of arbitrarily said if it's larger than 3/4, then I'm going to double the trust region radius. If it's sort of moderate, in this case I've said between 1/4 and 3/4, then I'm going to keep the trust region radius the same. If in fact I didn't do very well, and that ratio is less than 1/4, then I'm going to halve the trust region radius. And in the first two cases, I'm going to accept the new point, and in the second case, I'm going to reject the point. Okay, and that's the basic algorithm. And what makes this algorithm work, these values, of course, are somewhat arbitrary. This has got to be less than that, and this has got to increase the trust region radius, and this has got to reduce it. But the actual values you choose are somewhat arbitrary. I've just chosen those values there. But what really drives this is that I need to have a situation where I know that if I make the trust region radius small enough, I'm going to have a good model. So if I'm going to have a good model, I'm going to have good agreement. If I'm going to have good agreement, then I'm going to increase the size of the trust region radius. It's critical to the algorithm that one does that, and I'm going to try to indicate why. So in order to prove convergence, I need some assumptions. I need, if I'm going to have a second order method, that the function is twice continuously differentiable. I'm assuming the function is bounded below, so the minimum is well defined. And I actually need a bounded Hessian to make the convergence go through. And on the model, I need to have at every point that the model is twice continuously differentiable if I want a second order algorithm, that it interpolates the function at whichever point you're evaluating it, and that it also interpolates the gradient, because the actual basis that drives the algorithm is going to be a steepest descent-like method. Yes? Right. That's correct. But I'll cheat, because what I'll do is I'll say these are my assumptions. Because I'm using a problem without derivatives, I'm going to approximately solve the problem. And I can take a problem that is close, or as close as I like, to the noisy problem, for which all my assumptions are true. Okay, so I agree with you. If I'm solving a noisy problem, I may not have very nice Hessians. But I make assumptions that make the algorithm work, and then I say, in reality, I could take a problem which was sufficiently smooth that would be close enough to the noisy problem that I might as well pretend that's the problem I'm solving. Okay? So I'm cheating. We can talk about it afterwards. But you're quite right. I mean, what you said is a fair criticism, but my answer is the correct answer. Because that's what I do. And in the model, I also assume that the Hessian is bounded. So now I'm going to look at the standard model in the differentiable case. Even though I'm interested in the non-differentiable case, I'm looking at the differentiable case right now. So I'm saying that a typical truss region or line search method builds linear or quadratic models, and those models have to satisfy something like Taylor series error bounds. So for example, if I took a first order model, then you're going to get an error of order delta squared if you're thinking of truss region methods, or 8 squared if you're thinking of a line search method, and of course the gradients will be one order less. Or if you take a second order model, that goes up, and you've got order delta cubed here, but now you've got bounds of order delta on the Hessian. So if you think of doing a truncated Taylor series, these are the typical error bounds that you're going to get. And remember, I'm talking now about the differentiable case. So in fact, it's typical in the differential case to take either a first order Taylor series model, a second order Taylor series approximation, and that second order Taylor series approximation may be doing something like using quasi-Newton methods to approximate the Hessian. So it may not really be a second order Taylor series, but something that's close enough to it to get superlinear convergence. And in fact, in the case where you're looking at derivative-based methods, those big O terms depend only on the function f and its derivatives, and nothing else. And the other important thing is that by reducing the truss region or step size, one guarantees better accuracy, right? The smaller the neighborhood for the Taylor series expansion, the better a model that is for the true function, assuming the true function is sufficiently differentiable. So this is what makes it work. So this is really the fundamental result. This point here is what's called the Cauchy point, and that's the minimum that you get if you solve the truss region model problem in the steepest descent direction. Okay, so you can think, if I've got a quadratic form, which is my truncated Taylor series, I go off in the direction minus the gradient and try and find the minimum in that direction with the truss region, you can imagine that's a trivial problem to solve. I mean, you can write it down on the back of an envelope, and in fact, assuming the Hessian's bounded, this is the term you get if the minimum lies within the truss region, and the other one's the term you get if you actually have the minimum outside the truss region, so you have to step back and take a step of length delta. So it's really a trivial back-of-the-envelope calculation to get this bound. And it's that which is, in fact, going to give us our fundamental result. Whoops. Because we already agreed that delta doesn't go down to zero. Because we said if we take a truncated Taylor series approximation, the smaller the neighborhood, the more accurate the approximation. And if the approximation's accurate, delta's going to be bigger than 0.75, rho is going to be bigger than 0.75, and you're going to double your truss region. So that means that delta k cannot go to zero. But I've got this bound here, so if in fact my function is bounded below, the only conclusion that I can have is that gk has to tend to zero, the gradient has to tend to zero, as I go through my sequence. But that's my first order stationarity conditions. So this sort of simple back of the envelope calculation says that if I take a sequence of these steps, I'm going to converge to a point where the gradient is going to zero. That is, I'm going to converge to a point that satisfies the first order stationarity conditions. And in very rough terms, that's what makes trust region methods work. Now, in fact, you don't have to do it accurately. You can do something which is within some fraction of that decrease and get exactly the same result. So, in fact, you don't normally solve the problem exactly to the Cauchy point. You just use a sufficient model decrease. So, again, I repeat that this is based on a first-order model. It's just better than the Cauchy point, which is the steepest descent minima that you have to do. Now, it doesn't really take a genius to decide, well, what am I going to do if I want to solve the same kind of problem, but I don't have derivatives? I mean, I think the first thing that everyone would guess is, okay, let's use an interpolation model. Okay, so for example, if I'm going to use a quadratic interpolation model, I can just do what I've got here. So I'm just going to interpolate this. How many points do I need? Well, I've got a constant, and I've got my n points from the linear approximation. That's n plus 1 points. And then I've got, well, this is a symmetric Hessian, so I've got, you know, the upper triangular part including the diagonal, and that means I require that many points. So let's see how this works. So now I'm taking a different model. I'm taking the model from interpolation. I don't need the derivatives. I'm not using a Taylor series model. So let's go and minimize it. So here's my picture. So I'm starting off with my 6 points. Because this is a two-dimensional, that's all I can draw. So I need 2 plus 2 over 2 points, which is 6. And what I've got here is my quadratic model, and where you can see the color, that's where it's above the true function. So I started off at this point. I minimized the quadratic model and got to x1. I now go to the next step. And I actually must have had failure, because you'll notice the truss region radius has decreased. So what actually happened was when I minimized with the other truss region, I got a point over here somewhere. But in fact, when I compared that to the true function, the comparison was bad. So I cut back the truss region radius by half, played the same game again, and got to this point. Okay. And now I look at the next iteration. And I got moderate success, because the truss region radius stayed the same. But I've got the minimum here. And now, at the next point, what's going to happen? I get an awful model. Okay? Now, actually, the reason I've got an awful model is because these points have started to line up. So what's the problem? The problem is that the model depends on the previous iterates. So unlike the case where you had a Taylor series expansion and those big O terms depended only on the function at the point and its derivatives, in this case, our big O terms depend on the sample set that we're using for the interpolation. And that's a problem. So the big O in Taylor-like bounds depends not only on F, but also on the geometry of the sample set. So we need to have some way of characterizing that geometry. And in fact, what we would like to do is to control that so that the constant that determines the characterization of the sample set is actually uniformly bounded. And much to my astonishment, I mean, like most of us who don't necessarily work in approximation theory, you know, I did univariate approximation when I was an undergraduate, I guess, so I knew about Lagrange polynomials and the way one did interpolation. So I assumed that these bounds, or these Taylor series-like bounds that I was looking for, would be available in multivariate interpolation and were probably 19th century results. So much to my astonishment, the first result I could find was about 1990, and was in fact fairly complicated. And what I want to show you here is that we can do what we need to do in a relatively straightforward way. So my truss region subproblems are now going to be defined by linear or quadratic models that are built by multivariate polynomial interpolation. So somehow I need to deal with approximate gradients and Hessians. And I want to retain the same kinds of global convergence. And it turns out I can do that. Now, I said in the case where I had derivatives, I need to do at least as well as the Cauchy point, meaning I need to do at least as well as a steepest descent or a first order method. The equivalent statement here is I need to have good linear interpolation models in order for convergence to stationary points. And I'll talk about what well poisonous is, but essentially it's well poisonous that guarantees you have good geometry for the sample sets. And I can get global convergence to second order critical points and faster convergence by using fully quadratic models. Okay, but if you think of fully quadratic models, you know, if you've got n plus 1, n plus 2 over 2 points, you don't need that large a problem for that to be a fair number of points if it takes an hour or two to get a single function evaluation. So in fact, you know, you can't do a lot of fully quadratic model steps in the context that we're looking at here. So now I want to look at how we go about looking at these error terms and how we go about controlling them. And I'm going to describe it in detail for the linear case because that's relatively straightforward. So I'm going to look at a function that's defined from Rn to R, and I'm going to consider n plus 1 interpolation points because that's what I need to get a fully linear model, right? N for the linear terms and 1 for the constant term. And I'm going to look at that in a truss region or a closed ball of radius delta. So that's what my model looks like. There's my n plus 1, 1 here, and n there for the unknowns. So you determine those unknowns by looking at the n plus 1 interpolation conditions. Same kind of thing we did when we did univariate interpolation. And if you look at the coefficient matrix, that's what the coefficient matrix looks like. And if that system's non-singular, you have a unique solution, and you say the set of points is poised, and of course the polynomial conditions, the polynomial coefficients are well-defined and unique. Otherwise, we say the set is non-poised, but since we're in the context where we actually care about the computation, you know, we also care about when it's close to being poised or non-poised, because we've got to look at this not just from a theoretical point of view, but also from a numerical point of view. Okay, and what I'm going to try to convince you, and it's really quite enlightening if you go into it in more detail and you compare it to the more general results that other people proved in the past, the proofs of this are going to be very straightforward. So I'm going to look at the error term for the function, the error term for the gradient, and then I'm going to manipulate it in a relatively straightforward way. So, you know, if I take my general model with the error term, take my interpolation conditions, subtract this away from this, well, you know, the differences in the linear model is going to give me this term. And then I've got f of yi minus f of x from here and minus my error term. And then what I can do is use my Taylor series expansion for this, because remember I've made the correct assumptions, if you like, for the true function f that I want to minimize, even though I'm not using those gradients. So if I do that, I'm going to get from here, you know, yi minus x times the gradient of f and big O delta squared terms. But now if I look at this term here, look, so I'm looking at yi minus x times g, that's this times g, take that over to the other side, and the g term goes out with the grad f, and you just get left with the eg term. So the, you know, just straightforward manipulation of the Taylor series expansion in here and bring it over to the left-hand side. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these away in pairs. Because if I take these off in pairs, I'm going to get rid of this term. Okay? And so I finally get left with this system of equations. We know I've written there big O delta squared, but if I look at the truncation arguments for Taylor series, I can tell you exactly what that expression is, right? Because I just got that from the truncation terms in the Taylor series expansion about here. So if I look at that in matrix notation, I'm writing it down like this, and you notice that matrix that we had did not depend on the general point x. We got rid of it. We only got the interpolation points on the left-hand side. So in fact, in general, if I look at the case where n equals 2, that's what that matrix would look like. But actually, I don't want to work with that matrix. Remember, it wasn't square. I'm going to work with the square submatrix. So I'm actually going to work with a matrix like this, which in the particular case we're looking at here would have reduced to that. Okay, and I make the comments because it's relevant later on, that the points actually appear in there by rows. So and we're going to take y0 equals 0 without loss of generality, and then you're going to get your interpolation points appearing by rows in the matrix. So now I can have some idea, maybe, of how to define this well-poisonedness, which is a sort of generalization of the unique solution to the linear system. So this is a possible definition. I'm going to take my points. I'm looking at the linear case, y1 to yn plus 1, and I'm going to say it's lambda-poised if the inverse of that coefficient matrix is bounded by capital lambda over delta. Okay? Or I could do it in an unscaled way and sort of write it like this. And actually, if you think about this for a minute, remember this was those points yi minus yj, those were points in the ball of radius delta. So when I've scaled it by delta, what I'm really doing is putting it in a ball of radius 1. Okay? And so now my definition of poisonedness could be written in that term. And just as an aside, it's obvious that lambda poisonous implies poisonous. I mean, if you just look at taking this away from this and this away from this, you get the same thing over there. So if this is non-singular, that is, and vice versa. Now, I said those right-hand side, those big O delta squared terms, they involve Taylor's expansions. So if you actually look at the details of what they are, this is what that big O term was. And now, if I assume that this is lambda poised, so now I'm going to get a lambda over delta, that's going to cancel out with this, and so I'm going to get order delta, and of course that's what you'd expect. If I've got order delta squared for F, I expect to get order delta for G. So I get this bound now on EG, and finally if I go back to the other system, this is now of order delta, put that in there, this is of order delta, because these are points in the ball of order delta, so that's of order delta squared, this is of order delta squared, so now I get the error in F is of order delta squared. And again, if you actually look at the details, that's what you get. So finally, the theorem that you have is, given a set of n plus 1 points and the function that is once continuously differentiable, and let L hat be that scaled matrix that's multiplied by 1 over delta, then you get those Taylor series bounds. And the point is, now that I've got these Taylor series bounds, I can use all the analysis that you have for smooth truss region methods and get it to work in the interpolation case. Okay, and obviously the smaller this is, the better the smaller the terms are on the right-hand side, so the better the approximations. Okay, more generally, if I have just an arbitrary polynomial basis, what I would do is I'd look at my approximation as being a linear combination of these. So this is what would have happened with the natural basis. I could think of that basis, or more generally, I can just think of my phis and just take a linear combination of the basis functions, use that for my model. Again, if I'm using linear or whatever, I'm going to do my interpolation at the required number of points, and if you write down the system, your coefficient matrix looks like this, and again, I'm going to get a unique solution if and only if this system is non-singular. If I've got a square system. So one thing you might say is, okay, why don't I, since this seems to depend upon non-singularity, why don't I think of my idea of well-poisonedness in terms of the condition number of this matrix? But in fact, that's not a very good idea, because the condition number depends on the basis, and I would like to have something which is basis independent. So in fact, I'm going to use a different definition of lambda poisonedness. So what I'm going to say here is that this set is lambda-poised if I look at the linear combination of these functions in the basis for the basis that I'm using, and if the infinity norm of lambda is bounded above by capital lambda, then I'm going to call that well-poised. And using that definition, that's independent of the basis, and it's independent of the scaling. And so notice now I've sort of changed the way I've written this down. Instead of looking in terms of a bound on the inverse of that scaled matrix, I'm just looking at a bound on these coefficient functions, lambda I. Now let's try and do the same thing in the quadratic case. I'm not going to go through all the details because they're more complicated, but the idea is essentially the same. You know, you're going to have more points, you're going to take a larger system, you need your n plus 1, n plus 2 over 1 points to get all your coefficients. And what happens is if you look at that matrix, you know, the matrix you get when you do the error analysis, it's a bit harder to play the game, but it's essentially the same game. You get a matrix like this. Okay, so before we had terms like this, but now, and it's not that surprising, right? It's just the difference of the basis functions. So that's what your matrix looks like when you do the manipulation. And again, notice that these points y appear by rows. So if you think of the y0s as being 0, you get y1s in this row, y2s in this row, y3s in that row, and so on. And that ends up being of some significance. Now I'd like to connect what I've done here to the condition number. So if I look at the submatrix, so I'm just looking at the P by P block if I've got P plus 1 interpolation points, and if I pretend that Y0 equals 0, this is what my matrix looks like. And then here's the following theorem, and this is the trick, and this was something which was well known in multivariate interpolation, but was never transparent as to what the reason was. If I think of these points as being my points, you know, even if you think of them as Y1 minus Y0, as points being in my sphere or my region of radius delta. If I want to scale that to a region of radius 1, these are going to be divided by delta, but these terms are all going to be divided by delta squared. And so it turns out that, in fact, if you want to make the right statements vis-a-vis the condition number, you've got to block scale it by the orders of the polynomials. And as I say, that was known in multivariate interpolation, but the explanation for it was fairly complicated, and here it's really transparent. It's basically saying if you want to have a scale invariant definition of well-poisonedness, one way of thinking of it is think in terms of being in a unit sphere. If you think in terms of being in a unit sphere, this is how you've got to scale that matrix. And then the result that you can in fact prove is that essentially your system is well-poised in the sense that I defined before, if and only if the scaled matrix is bounded by lambda. I say essentially because the constant's slightly different in the other direction. But it's kind of a nice result because now you can make conditioning statements that are independent of the basis and independent of the scaling. So finally, the theorem I had up before, I'm going to write up a theorem in the quadratic case. So now, of course, the function is of order delta cubed. The gradient differences are of order delta, and the Hessians are of order, delta squared, and Hessians are of order delta. And although I haven't gone through the arguments and they're a bit more complicated, they're really essentially the same kind of arguments as the fairly trivial proof in the linear case. And that's the value of the constants. Okay. Now you can actually extend this for non-square systems, and it's kind of fun. And if any of you are going to be at the meeting that's at the University of Toronto later this week on computational things, I'll be talking about that there. And you can actually do generalizations of Lagrange polynomials which apply to non-square systems, so it's also fun. And it's useful to be able to do that because if you've got noise, for example, with random distribution with mean zero, so a normal distribution with mean zero, then in fact the more points you take, you're kind of smoothing out the noise. So that's a context in which it may well make sense to use regression instead of interpolation. Also, if there are situations where you don't want to compute the well-poised set, if you take a lot of points, then with high probability, you're going to have a subset that's well-poised, and so the conditions and results that you can prove in the well-poised case will apply if you do regression instead of interpolation there. Okay, now I want to talk about the next subject, which is the case where I do have derivatives, and I'm going to cheat a bit because I was worried about running out of time, and I know that some of you were here when Andreas Vector was talking about his code IPOPT, and this is more his work than mine, so it's more appropriate to hear him talk about it than me. So I'm going to state what the approach is, then I'm going to talk a bit about the application, and then if we have time, I can give some of the details of IPOPT. So again, I'm looking at a nonlinear problem, nonlinear objective function, nonlinear equality constraints and simple bounds. I've just taken positivity in this case. for simplicity. And if I have the inequality, of course I could add a slack variable and put it in this form. And the approach that we're going to take is to use a log barrier function. So we're going to basically replace these two by f minus the log barrier term. And you can see that as your x gets close to zero, log of x gets close to minus infinity, you're multiplying it by minus, so you're going to push up the value. So if you're minimizing, you're going to have to stay away from x equals zero. And in loose terms, that's how barrier techniques work. So this penalty is always there, this barrier is always there, but in order to be able to finally get close to the boundary, you're going to have to reduce this. So that's the context in which you're looking at the problem. So an outer algorithm says, you know, I'm given an initial point, I'm given an initial barrier parameter, I'm going to compute an approximate solution to this problem, I'm going to decrease the barrier and iterate on that. And there's lots and lots of analysis. I just picked this one because it has my name in it and nothing else, but there's so many different analyses of interior point methods. And the best known implementations are Nitro, Loco, and IPOpt. And IPOpt is Andreas's. That's what, he was talking here about that within the month, wasn't it? Or was it a month ago? Relatively recently, anyway. So what I want to talk about first is the application to circuit tuning of this sort of differentiable technique. So EinsTuner is an IBM internal software tool which is used for the design of custom digital circuits. It used to use Lancelot, which is what Thomas referred to before. Lancelot is an augmented Lagrangian technique. Lancelot was, I think, a pretty good piece of code in 1990, but you know, that's 15 years ago. I think our subject would be in a poor state if we couldn't do things better 15 years later than we could do in the past. And actually, we're much better off, and I hope to show you that, using Andreas's code these days. It has to be customized, so you have to worry about noise. You never get into the asymptotic, so you have to be aggressive in the way that you approach the problem. There's some pre-processing that you can do to get rid of some of the degeneracy in the problem, which we call pruning. You don't change the problem, you don't approximate it, you write it in an equivalent form, and I'll give you some idea of what that involves. But it cuts down the number of variables and the number of constraints by a significant percentage, so it's certainly worth doing. And it's used for the design of essentially every custom digital chip in IBM. And typically you get a 15% gain over carefully hand-tuned circuits. So, you know, it's not something to be sneezed at. So, you know, if you think of a circuit, and really this fall is up here to show that if you want to get people to use your software, you've got to be in an environment that those people are comfortable in. So this was the kind of environment that the circuit designers at IBM were using before Lancelot or IPOpt ever came on the scene. But if we told them they've got to input it a completely different way, they never would have used it. So you've got signals arriving at one end, they're going through the circuit, you know, various things are happening through the circuit rapidly, the switches at gates are of order 10 to the minus 12 seconds, and you've got output coming out at the other end. And you can change the speed of these gates by changing the widths of the transistor. So actually, as you go through the process, these widths come up on the screen. The circuit designers can see what's going on. They can make certain considerations of things that they want to have moved together or things that they don't want to touch. So they've got, you know, a kind of environment that they're happy with and used to. We want to optimize possibly various aspects of the circuit, maybe the delay of the signals, the area consumption, because we like our chips to be as small as possible, the power consumption, because you don't want to burn your lap when you've got a laptop on it. And the way to do this is essentially by choosing the right sizes for the transistors. Often, I think Chandy would say always, the circuit is far too big for us to actually do the optimization we'd like to do, so you have to simplify it. You have to either cut it up in pieces or move things together or fix some of the transistors. So in some sense, you get suboptimal solutions, but we still get, we hope, good solutions. Currently, we're tuning circuits with up to about 71,000 transistors, and there's a strong incentive to be able to choose larger and larger ones in less and less time. That's no surprise. Let me look at what the mathematical formulation of this problem is. So, you know, here's my signals coming in, so there's the arrival times, and then there's a delay. So this is a nonlinear function. And so if I look at the arrival time here, it's whatever the arrival time was there, plus the delay function. And if I want to make certain that I'm going to get to the right place at the right time, I've got to have this to be the maximum of these two, and I want to make that to be as small as possible. And I'm going to follow that all the way through the circuit, and the idea is you've got to get the right thing at the right-hand side. You want to get here as quickly as you possibly can. So if you formulate that, I mean, I've just put over here exactly what I just said. So for example, if you look at AT5, AT5 is the maximum of this plus this and this plus this. So you're sort of pessimistic as to what's actually going to happen in the circuit. So in general, the ATJs are the maximum of the ATIs plus DIJs, where I is included I is the input for node J. And these delays are actually functions of the transistor width and also the slews, as we'll see in a minute. Have I missed something out? No. Okay. So if we look at that, there are other constraints that are around, but what I want to show you first is this min-max problem, which is what I had before, can be written, this is a non-smooth problem, but it can be written as a smooth problem by cheating. So if I rewrite this as a nonlinear programming problem, if I make Z as small as possible, or in this country Z as small as possible, and Z is greater than or equal to all the FIs, what I'm actually doing is minimizing the maximum of the FIs. So we use that trick, which is a well-known trick, to reformulate the problem. So we've got that. We've got some slew constraints that also depend on the transistor widths. This is an area constraint, which is a fairly crude measure of area. It basically says the area is going to be the sum or weighted sum of the transistor widths. We have some constraints on the capacitances. We have some constraints on the ratios of the widths of the PFETs and the MFETs, and we've got simple bound. That's essentially the optimization problem that we want to solve. So these nonlinear functions are functions of the transistor widths and the slews. They're obtained by SPECS, which is Chandu's absolutely brilliant circuit simulator. I mean, it's been around for a long time and still does the job as well. Unlike Lancelot, Lancelot's become obsolete. SPECS is not. Still does as good a job now as it did then. It's very fast compared to standard circuit simulators. You get the first derivatives. It's the most computationally expensive part in the optimization. It actually wasn't when Lancelot was around, because Lancelot was not as good as IPR, as I'll show you. And there is some numerical noise, mostly from the integration. So after the optimization, we don't actually build transistors, any width you like. They've got to be snapped to a particular grid. So that means that in some sense, we don't have to have highly accurate solutions. I don't think accuracy is our problem, it's speed and size, which is a much bigger problem for us. There are many degenerate variables, and that's why we want to do this pruning. And if you think of what's going on here, you've got these paths going through the circuit, and what you want to do is you want to minimize the worst path. I mean, that's what you're trying to do in order to get a fast circuit. So if you think of any path which is not critical, you can change the value of the transistor widths there without changing the solution at all. So you've got non-unique solutions. In fact, you've got lots and lots of non-unique solutions. So that's why it's highly degenerate. And the computation time can be up to several days, although, again, it's much faster now than it was in the old days. So let me give you some idea of pruning. And, I mean, it's worth talking about this just because it's very simple. And, in fact, you can write down a rather trivial graph theory algorithm that guarantees to determine the right thing when you want to do the pruning. It's something anybody could have done, but nobody before was interested in that structure because it was too trivial and not relevant, but it made a significant difference in these problems. So here I'm looking at a part of the circuit, and you see what I could do is I could rewrite this problem, and let me do it right now. I could get rid of this node and replace it by the sum of these and the sum of these. So I've got rid of one variable, and I've replaced three constraints by two. So I've reduced the size of the problem. But it's a fairly trivial thing to do, and you can do it again. And that's essentially what's going on in pruning. And, of course, you can write down the algorithm which says, go through the graph very rapidly and determine what pruning is worth doing, And as I said, if you do that, you reduce the degeneracy considerably, and that helps the solution, even though it's a very simple idea. I should think in terms of finishing, but I think I started a bit late, right? A little bit. So, there's approximation of second derivatives. Ideally, what you'd like to do is to approximate using the projected Hessians, but in fact, that ends up being not possible because the reduced space Hessian's too large and too dense to be able to do things. So in fact, what you end up doing is using what's called limited memory BFGS and using Sherman, Morris, and Woodbury to update the approximations. You try to make it very aggressive because, as I said, you never get into the asymptotics, so you want to try to get as big a bang for the buck as you can early on. You try to make it less sensitive to noise. You terminate as quickly as you possibly can. I still remember the old days when Chandy used to see Lancelot going on this thing, and I was very happy because I was getting very accurate solutions to, in fact, much simpler problems than the ones we had to eventually solve. And Chandy would always scowl at me and say, why are you not stopping? Why are you wasting all these hundreds and hundreds of evaluations going almost nowhere? You never really get into the asymptotics in these problems. But if you look at the results, so here's a benchmark set of, I think it was around 60 problems. What you're seeing here is the amount of time taken by the simulation. What you're seeing here is the amount of time taken by Lancelot. And the rest is, you know, time in and I/O things and so forth. If you now look at what happens, you can see that the IP opt has almost disappeared. It's these little bits here. This is the linear algebra, which I guess before was, to be fair, included in Lancelot. But you can see now that, in fact, the simulation is really where most of the time is being spent. So overall, IPOPT is actually more robust. You can't see that from those foils, but I have a slide to show it, but I probably don't have time to show it to you. But it certainly is much more robust and efficient than Lancelot. There's some parallel computation going on since April 2003, so 2 years, just over 2 years, it's been the default optimization used in EinsTuner. There are still things we'd like to do more on. We'd like to do a better job of handling noise. We'd like to make it more robust. In feasibility with these problems, whether you're using Lancelot or IPOPT, in feasibility is a difficulty because it takes a long time to decide it's infeasible. It's very skeptical about infeasibility. It sort of just believes it's not doing the problem properly. So it takes too long to say it's actually an infeasible problem. And engineers do give infeasible problems, sometimes because they're careless and sometimes because it's hard to tell what a feasible problem is the first time you try it. It would be nice to do much more parallelization. We actually have a project which has started to look at mixed integer nonlinear programming, and you can imagine that's a very difficult topic. So we'd like to handle discrete variables. The question mark should really be about this big because we've only just started and it's going to be a pretty hard topic to look at. But we are at least looking at it. And I think maybe this will be a good time for me to start. I was going to go into some details of IPOP, but I probably won't finish it in time. And I know that some of you heard it from Andreas, and I'm sure he did a better job of it than I would. Okay, thank you. Either bored you or blinded you, or both. Sorry? I didn't hear the question. Could you say it again? No, we always did the pruning. So the pruning, in fact, the statistics I gave up there were the results for Lancelot. I'm not really certain whether it improved the speed in IPOPT as much as it did in Lancelot, but in some sense it's still a very good idea because it's very cheap and you definitely made the problem easier. You've got rid of some of the degeneracy and you've reduced the size of the problem at, you know, minimal cost.